Hello and welcome to Volume 121 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about the different views from the founders of forestry. We'll talk about ticks and insects, and we'll talk about a movement to eliminate the death tax. And as always, we'll check up on the timber prices. I'm Hayes Brown, General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Dick Patton is president of the American Business Defense Council in Washington, D.C., and he's been working with members of Congress who are interested in the total elimination of the death tax. Welcome, Dick.
Thanks for having me on.
Remind us what the current rate of the federal estate tax is now.
The federal estate tax right now has an exemption of $5.45 million, and the rate of persons' estate beyond that is 40%.
Okay. So it's not a trifling number, is it?
That's not a trifling number, and particularly if you've got a well-capitalized business of any kind, or a farm, we're talking something that is painful and sometimes devastating.
What is there a way that the death tax uniquely affects people who own forest lands or businesses?
Actually, it does. And what we have found is, and this is my personal belief, is that forest landowners get the pointy end of the spear of the death tax worse than about any other category of family business. And the reason is the IRS will come in and assess the land at what they call highest and best use. You know, that means if you're to put in a hunting lodge or a hotel or something like that, then that would be highest and best use. And then they start going through your land and estimating board feet whether those trees are ready to harvest or not. And then they figure out your death tax, and they give it to the family, and the family has 9 months to produce the cash after, let's say, dad dies or grandpa dies. And this is something that, has caused massive selling of land, massive clear cutting of land when that wasn't in the family's plan to begin with. But these are the things that that the IRS forces families to do when dad or grandpa dies in the name of the death tax.
In the current political climate, what do you see as opportunities to repeal the death tax entirely?
This movement is moving forward. About a year ago, this time, we passed the death tax repeal bill of 2015 in the House of Representatives. It was a large and bipartisan vote, and I can actually tell you somewhat personally and frankly that the text and the content of that bill was put together by myself and Kevin Brady. And Kevin Brady is currently the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And I've been in this movement for quite some time. I've been in Washington, D.C. working on death tax repeal for the last 12 or 13 years. And we've worked on a lot of bills. I can tell you very honestly that this is the most solid bill, the best bill that we have ever had on death tax repeal. But we passed it through the House. And the next step, of course, is the Senate. We know that we've got 54 solid bipartisan votes in the Senate. We need another six to climb up over a Harry Reid filibuster, which will be has been promised to us. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dick. We appreciate that. The Property and Environment Research Center has been a source of reliable information for AFOA for many years, including our very first broadcast. So we're pleased to welcome its executive director, Reed Watson, and we've asked him to comment on a federal program that acquires private land, and it's innocuously called the Land and Water Conservation Fund. So welcome, Reed.
Thank you, Hayes. Great to be here.
What is this Land and Water Conservation Fund? How does it work, and what do you think are some problems with it?
Yeah, it's actually a 51-year-old piece of legislation. It's funded through offshore oil and gas royalties, mostly in the Gulf of Mexico, And its innocuous name, as you described it, I think is a bit of a misnomer. It's used primarily to expand the federal estate, to acquire private lands and turn them into federal lands. And we've focused in on it because it's up for reauthorization. It was temporarily reauthorized last year, and now it's a rider. It's included in the energy bill that are pending before Senate and in the House. And the issue that we see is that, you know, aside from the acquisition of private lands, which are, you know, often generating very valuable conservation benefits themselves, the federal estate is really poorly mismanaged. There's a strong energy or support for growing the federal estate, but we're not maintaining federal lands. In fact, the National Park Service is now currently running about a $12 billion maintenance backlog, deferred maintenance, that projects that need to be done that aren't being funded. And yet there's this growing push to continue to expand the federal estate. So we've zeroed in on the Land and Water Conservation Fund, or LWCF, as really an unnecessary approach to turning private land into public land, and oftentimes reducing the conservation benefits that flow from those lands.
Does this bill sunset, or does it need to be reauthorized, or, you know, what's it?
It sunset last year, and there was a temporary reauthorization, a three-year reauthorization. Now what's pending before Congress is a permanent reauthorization. And before that happens, before forever is a long time, before we do that, we think there ought to be some pretty significant reforms to the law, namely to stop acquiring and growing this federal estate if we're not currently maintaining it.
What do you see are some solutions for managing federal lands more effectively?
Well, for one, I think we ought to maintain what we've got. That should be a priority over adding more acres. But to the extent to which we are going to add more acres or swap federal lands for private and private for federal, we could use land swaps. We could use conservation easements instead of acquiring lands. We could swap the oftentimes the issue is in-hold acres, private in-holdings that are surrounded by national park or national forest, and rather than just paying for more land, we could swap those in-held private acres for lands on the margin. We could also use user fees to the extent to which public lands generate all these different recreational demands. They meet those demands, or they are national parks. We could charge user fees to actually address some of the deferred maintenance issues. We don't necessarily need to keep acquiring more lands if we're not going to adequately maintain them.
So you're promoting a no net loss of private property idea then?
I think, yeah, we are. In fact, we haven't articulated as such, but I think, and your first speaker, Mr. Patton, I think was getting at this as well, is there are a lot of policies that discourage private land conservation, the death tax being one. And they actually encourage the conversion of forest lands and other working lands into other uses. And I think we need to recognize that public lands are not the only ones that generate conservation benefits. Private lands also do that. They generate water quality improvements, habitat for endangered species and others. And we ought to recognize as a country that it doesn't have to be owned by the federal government to be conservation land, to be productive from an environmental perspective.
Well, that leads to... Yeah, thank you, Reed. That leads us to our next guest, Doug McCleary. Thank you, Reed. We appreciate that. Doug McCleary is an influential forest policy analyst, and he recently wrote a commentary in the Forestry Source that explored the relationship between Carl Schenck and Gifford Pinchot and their competing views on who could be trusted to manage forests. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Hayes. How are you?
Carl Schenck and Gifford Pinchot are kind of the founding fathers of forestry in the U.S. They were contemporaries in the early forest conservation movement, but how were their conservation approaches similar, and how were they different?
Yeah, let's set the stage a little bit, what these leaders were faced with. One, forests were being cleared for agriculture at the turn of the century at an astounding rate, averaging 13.5 square miles per day. For the last half of the century, wildfires were running unchecked through the forest, and wildlife essentially was a basket case. Many species common today were on the brink of extinction at the turn of the 19th century, of the 20th century. And so they really had a problem in front of them. The two had some common approaches. One, both agreed that for forests to remain on the landscape, forestry need to be made to pay economically, and that the way to manage forests was through judicious timber harvesting and to keep those forests healthy and productive and economically a part of the economy. And so scientific forestry were supported by both, adapted to local conditions. Both men started forestry schools, Carl Schenck on the Biltmore Estate in North Carolina, the first forestry school in the country, and both had, Pinchot, the Yale school. But there were significant differences between the two as well.
Now we've had many, many years to reflect on their two different views. What has the benefit of time taught us about the wisdom and effectiveness of these two different approaches? I guess Pinchot's being more federal control and Schenck being, you know, wise and judicious private control.
Yeah, Schenck felt that the proper approach was to work with private landowners, farmers, and timber companies to get the job done, much like the agriculture extension specialists were beginning to do at the time. Pinchot had lost faith in forest landowners to do the do what was necessary and wanted a stronger role for government. He felt that landowners would not have the economic incentives to do what they needed to do, and so advocated massive federal expansion, as well as a Federal Forest Practice Act governing all private lands in private forest lands in the United States. In terms of the outcome, I think generally history vindicates the much less understood and known Schenck's approach. But it did take a seriously long time to get there. It wasn't until after World War II that major investments in private forestry were made. But those have been very successful, and today private lands provide 90% of the nation's timber, and most agree that they're being managed in an environmentally responsible way.
Okay. Thank you, Doug, for that. For that information, and the full article can be seen on the website. We appreciate your contributions.
Sure.
Our next guest is Dave Milton, who's a broker and president of Southeastern Land Group. And we learned about Dave through his Saturday morning radio show called The Land Show in numerous markets in Alabama. Welcome, Dave.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for having me on the show today, Hayes.
Well, tell me why you decided to create the Land Show and what niche it fills.
Well, actually, I can't take credit. It was a friend of mine who, Ford Stokes, that owns Stokes and Partners there in Auburn, and they handle a lot of our ad marketing. And as we were expanding our footprint and our company from just Alabama to five states in the South, he kind of came to me with the idea and said, "Hey, look, you've been doing this 22 years and you traveled all over and met a lot of folks, and you and I have a lot of interesting conversations. I just think about land and land related topics. It's so broad, and we kind of segment the show and have a lot of different sort of micro topics within the macro topic of land. You know, we have a segment on timberland and that you'd find interesting, and farmland, and sort of a history section of history of Alabama and as it relates to rural Alabama. And we just have a land business segment. We normally have a main guest on, somebody that's over a state agency or somebody out of private industry. And then sometimes either me or some of our other guys that help host the show will do an in-the-field segment as we're out and about highlighting a farm or an agribusiness or ecotourism or, just anything related to rural Alabama.
Well, that's a wide variety of topics. How do you generate your topics, and how do you find ideas that you think are of interest to people?
Well, one reason I agreed to do this is that we've got a team of 20 guys in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, and And all these guys love, you know, the rural lifestyle, rural economy, and there's actually a lot of guys within our team that have, you know, different specialties. We have a timber sales division and several foresters that work in that division, and we also have guys that focus on cattle farms, poultry farms. So we've got a guy that's a peanut farmer down in South Alabama, and another guy that's that kind of more of a rural economist and sort of has that background. So a couple of guys that are pretty well known in the sporting world, you know, as hunters and why they writ about George Mann and Tim Baker would be the two guys that are really well known in hunting and fishing. So it's just been interesting to bring those pieces in, and then I kind of decide the main guests through my contacts. I just call people that I know, and I also ask for ideas from our audience, and they email us, and we get ideas, and it's a great interplay.
Well, that brings me to my last question. Are listeners able to call in and ask questions and interact with
you? Oh, absolutely. The best way is just to email us at info@thelandshow.com, and we get a lot of emails, get a lot of ideas, and some of the farms that we spotlighted and some of the rural businesses that we spotlighted have come from emails and or questions. You know, people have questions about a lot of different topics, and so we're happy to try to answer the questions. And a lot of times we don't have the immediate answer, but we can pull together you know, people that we know and related businesses and put together the right answer for our listeners.
And so the program airs on Saturday morning, right? At what time?
Saturday morning at 9 a.m. It's on 8 stations throughout Alabama, or you can go to thelandshow.com and you can listen to the podcast, and we have blogs, and you can listen to all the shows that we've done over the year. Just love for folks to check it out.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave. We appreciate that.
John Stivers is president of the Alabama Prescribed Fire Council. One of our members called with a concern that his neighbor, who is about to do a prescribed burn, might not be as vigilant in making sure that the fire didn't get across the line. So we wanted to talk to John about that type of situation. Hello, John.
Hello. Thank you.
What is the legal responsibility for prescribed burners when it comes to notifying your neighbor when you're planning on conducting a burn?
Now, this may sound odd, but the legal responsibility, that there is not one, and there shouldn't be one. Right now, the law doesn't require a burner to contact the adjoining landowner. All the burner has to do is get an authorization from the Alabama Forestry Commission, and when they do that, the burner is agreeing that they've got the ability, you know, to contain, confine, and control the fire until it's out. Now, this, you know, just basically implies they've got adequate horsepower to keep the fire, you know, in the trenches on that particular burn unit. So, again, there is no legal responsibility for a burner to contact their neighbor.
Okay. But if you wish to be a good neighbor and wish to adequately prepare and plan for these burns, what are some things that you should do?
Okay, this isn't an all-inclusive list, but just here's four, five, six examples of, you know, being a good neighbor. And you need to be a good neighbor when you burn. And the best way to sum it up is just three simple words: own your smoke. You know, smoke is the thing that typically causes the concern, the impacts, it's most visible. So the best way to own your smoke is just, you know, perform smoke screening. And when you do smoke screening, you're identifying potential smoke-sensitive areas from your smoke. You know, that's your fire, that's your smoke. The second thing you want to do, other than, again, clearly smoke screen so you know where your smoke's going to go, is to reduce your adjacent landowner's fear, and most people do have a fear of fire, by a couple of ways. One, you know, if you become a certified prescribed burn manager, then you're going to do a much better job of knowing what's going to happen. You know, you're not guessing at it. So that's one, be a certified burn manager. And then secondly, in this day and time, just make sure you have adequate insurance. I mean, if you're out there without insurance, you're taking some huge risk, and you don't need to do that. And then another example of being a good neighbor to reduce that fear and to own your smoke and to keep your fire contained is have good fire lines in before you do the burn. And that implies you've got a well thought out, a written burn plan. You've thought about contingencies. You've identified how many people do you need, who needs to be contacted. And if you just do those basic things, the old rule of thumb is, you know, common sense will take you way down the road. You will be a good neighbor. You don't have to get your neighbor's permission, but you want to be, you know, treat your neighbor like yourself, the old golden rule. So it's not asking a lot to be a good neighbor when you do a burn.
Who should a burner contact, though, before doing a fire, just as a matter of protocol?
Okay, obviously the Alabama Forestry Commission for a burn authorization. That's one. I would call the county 911 office, which puts the sheriff and VFDs on alert. And again, any stakeholder that's immediately in the area you want to burn, where's your smoke going to go? Who's the stakeholders that need to know, possibly, so you avoid conflicts? So again, that's basically it. It's just your smoke is the biggest problem. You know, we don't need any more laws or requirements to make people notify people. Just use common sense, apply current regulations, and 99.9% of the time, you'll have a good outcome. Everybody will be happy.
All right. Well, thank you, John. We appreciate that.
Okay, one thing in closing, I'm going to make a shameless plug. September the 1st at Auburn University is our annual meeting for the Prescribed Fire Council, and our theme this year is, as a burner, are you being a good neighbor? So there's some information online that describes when it is, registration, but we're going to have a lot of presentations that address this theme specifically. So thanks for the opportunity to share.
Okay. Well, thank you. Bob Williams is a forestry consultant in New Jersey, and he's concerned that the general public prefers laws that promote preservation of forests as opposed to laws that make it more able for practice, the practice of forestry to be provided on a private scale. Welcome, Bob.
Hello.
I understand you're a little frustrated with the movement away from the Leopold Land Ethic type idea to a current preservation at all costs mentality that is pretty dominant in the public thought. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that is the issue confronting forestry in this country today. Of course, I live in the urban interface that's on steroids. And our citizens really have simply lost any relationship to the land. They don't know that milk comes from a cow, let alone that their, you know, wood floors came from someone's forest. So I think that they have been easily manipulated into believing that we need to buy all the land and not touch it. In fact, we should discourage people from, you know, utilizing the forest. We see that in New Jersey on a scale that would shock most of you. And I've often said that the people, particularly in the Southeast, as you become urbanized, you better pay attention because you may think you own your trees, but they'll pass laws and regulations that you'll find out that you really don't. So I come to believe that, you know, the forestry community really has to become very active in telling our story. And we do that in a number of ways. But I don't
give
believe
some ideas. Give some ideas about ways that you think the forestry community can act.
Well,
kind of reverse,
you know, what
trend
brought me to this forum here was we put up very large signs on our forestry projects that are pretty, number one, but they really help people understand that we're not building another Walmart and we're not clearing trees to have more houses, which is typically, if you see logging equipment, that means a housing tract is coming here in New Jersey. And it's a small thing in terms of, you know, the effort, but I think it's important. And every landowner, every forester, every logger, and every mill has to get involved here. And I think we have been our own worst enemy in not educating the public. While the preservationists, they rule the roost. The public is easily manipulated to believe that cutting trees is bad. The other thing is, I think things like this. You get the link to our talk today. We should share it with hundreds of people. It's unfortunate that we in forestry are saddled with the burden of trying to convince people of our positive story, but we are. And I think we gave it away in the last 30, 40 years. We've not gone to the table while the preservationist, they are well-oiled, well-organized machine that certainly knows how to get the public to believe that cutting trees is bad when we all know that many times it's essential to the health of the forest. So
these signs that you're talking about, just leveraging, you know, the fact that, that forest land may be on a public road, many people pass by and can read them. What's the message that you like to put on these signs?
Well, the message varies. Here in New Jersey, our forests are very prone to wildfires and southern pine beetle. We now have those, and we will hammer away at, you know, the without this work, thinning the forest, you know, we're going to be subject to horrendous fire and insects and disease. The public gets that. I don't believe the public's against forestry. I know that sounds a bit different, but I live with the public. I live near 50 million people, and I have consistently found that once they understand what we're doing and talking about, they're generally okay. They kind of say, well, you know, maybe I wouldn't cut my trees, but I think it's okay. You know, the preservationists would have us all believe that the public is with them. I think the people that have been able to suppress forestry are a very minimal minority, but they're loud and vocal and good at what they do. So I'm still optimistic that the public will buy into our message. We are permitted to do forestry, and of all places, New Jersey, on some larger scales, our public lands are not managed. We've yet to crack that nut, all in the name of preservation. And our earlier speaker about buying all the land, New Jersey is buying land like there's no land left on the planet. And it's bought, locked up, and thrown away. Mm-hmm. And we in forestry, it's our burden now to bring back, you know, that conservation ethic that some of our founding folks had it right.
All right. Well,
signs are one small thing.
Signs are one small way of doing it. Well, thank you, Bob. We appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
John Phillips is a widely known outdoorsman and has done a lot to introduce the topic to people who may not have grown up going outdoors, and we wanted to tap into his experience with the common pests of the forest, namely ticks and insects. Welcome, John.
Thanks, sir. Glad to be with you.
You spend a lot of time outdoors and with people who enjoy being outdoors. Have you known of anyone that's developed any health problems from exposure to ticks and other pests like mosquitoes?
Yeah, I've had several friends that have had Lyme disease, and it's been real debilitating for them. One of them was a TV host, and he was out of work for a year. He just couldn't get out of bed. And you know, when I was growing up and most of my life, I just go to the woods and don't think anything about it. But now we're discovering a lot of diseases that some of these pests and bugs carry. And the good news is there's ways to prevent it. And instead of looking at which bug spray or bug repellent is the best, I use a series of several different ones. I think they're all good, but, you know, I can't afford to be off a year and not make a living as an outdoor writer. So I use a closed bug spray that you can buy at most any sporting goods store. It doesn't have DEET in it. It has a perithiol, I think is what it's called. And it's made by Repel, and several other companies make these kind of things. You spray your clothes down with this that you're going to be in the woods with. You let them air dry for 24 hours, and they're supposed to keep bugs and ticks and red bugs and mosquitoes away or kill them for 6 washings. Now, that doesn't mean you have to live in your clothes for a week before you wash it either. I mean, you know, you can spray it down after 6 washings, and it's supposed to still be activated. And that's the first step that I use. But then I go one step further. I usually use thermosel, which is a little device that has some kind of bug repellent in it, and you turn it on, and a little plate on the back of it gets hot, and it gives off a kind of smoke or odor that doesn't seem to be detected by any of the animals that I hunt. And so there are a lot of different things that you can use. Sawyer's makes one of those clothes repellents, I think. And so I use it all. And they also have just come out with some different technology to where you can get some insect repellent that deer can't smell, and neither can any other game. So I use that too. When I'm going into the woods, and even when I'm wearing, you know, pretty high boots, I will put a little bit of sulfur around the top of my socks. I've always found that the sulfur keeps the ticks from coming up your leg and the red bugs too. So I just do it. And I get asked a lot of times, which one do you think is best? All of them.
Get one and try it out. Well, you've given us some great ideas, John. We appreciate that very much.
Yes, sir.
In our markets chair is T.R. Clark with F&W Forestry Services. Welcome, T.R.
Hey, good to be here.
Tell us about the timber market.
All right. Well, I mean, long story short, there hasn't been a whole lot of change in the overall timber market in the last few years. I mean, if you're keeping up with the major market overseers, Forest Market or Timber Mart South, or F&W provides a quarterly forestry report, or Marshall Thomas reports on the overall market. I mean, you're hearing the same story over and over again. I mean, we're all kind of waiting and wondering when the pre-housing bubble type stumpages will come back, and that all depends on new housing starts. And if somebody has the crystal ball that tells us when all that's actually going to happen, I'd like to get in on that. So, long story short, not a whole lot of change in the overall timber market, especially in the last few years. However, here in our region, we do see some seasonal fluctuations.
Talk about your local markets a little bit. You're in southeast Alabama, is that right?
Yeah, mid-eastern Alabama. We are, my office is actually about 30 minutes northeast of Auburn, close to the Georgia county line. And if you draw a Georgia state line, if you draw a 100-mile circle around Lafayette, that's, we pretty well operate in that region on a daily basis. So that's where our expertise is. But again, not a whole lot of fluctuation in our products here as a whole. We do see seasonal or weather-related fluctuations. Right now, we're in a kind of a typical summer-type pattern. Meal inventories are full, and, if you're on a tract where, if a logger's working on a tract where there is primarily one product type, such as the first thinning, where there is exclusively pine pulpwood, they're having a hard time making a full week out of those type properties, and that affects the stumpages. Whereas on the other side of the coin, if there is a tract with multiple timber products that are pretty evenly distributed, we're seeing very similar stumpage prices on those type tracts that we were seeing when conditions were wet. And the reason is, the loggers can make a full week on that type of track. When they run out of their pulpwood quota, then they can start hauling, hardwood or saw timber or something else.
Okay. Well, very good thoughts. Thank you, TR. We appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Thanks go to Dick Patton, Reed Watson, Doug McCleary, and Dave Milton. And we also appreciate the contributions of John Stivers, Bob Williams, John Phillips, and T.R. Clark. As Doug McCleary pointed out, there are essentially two views of who is a better manager of forests: public control, advocated by Pinchot, or private control, advocated by Schenck. In their time, the question remained unanswered. Based on the facts available at the time, either could have been right. But what have we learned in the following 110 years? Is government better able to promote the benefits that forests provide? Or is a private landowner who has a healthy market for his product better able to make wise decisions? On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.